Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation. I had a European moment on the top floor terrace earlier with Simone de Giovanni. We were standing there looking over Paris and spotted the Centre Pompidou in the background. And I said, oh, I went there with my school class when I was a pupil. And he said, so did I. And it warmed my heart because for obvious reasons, I'm in Edinburgh, which is in the UK. For now, and in the EU, and it warmed my heart. And obviously, the science is also warming my heart. So I'm going to talk about spinal cord repair mostly, and I'll try and wrap around where our research over the past long time has touched upon the question of whether regeneration is a recapitulation of development, or how far regeneration is a recapitulation of development. And I'll probably give it away with the first slide when I say regeneration is fundamentally different from development. And for many reasons, some are trivial. The size of the animal gets much larger. Growth is tremendous between a very small, in our case, fish that's maybe 2 millimeters long, 3 millimeters long, can swim to an adult that is 3 centimeters long and swims around, but also for many cellular reasons. So if you think about a spinal cord or any CNS tract that you transect, all hell breaks loose. Cells break open. You get calcium release. You get lots of dying cells. So something has to happen with the dying cells. You don't normally have them to this degree in the setup. After injury, you need to remove the debris. You need inflammation. You need resolution of inflammation for things to be repaired. If injured, you need to repair the blood-brain barrier. To inhibit infection from coming in, to limit inflammation. At the same time, if you repair the blood-brain barrier too well and you get scarring, then you can't get axons to cross the lesion site. So you need axons to rebridge that injury because function that is distal to the injury is lost, and you want to regain that. So that has to happen as well, and if they're scarred, it hasn't. And then lots of neurons have died, and if you haven't functioned to return, maybe you need to replace some of them. And ultimately, your new network might look a little bit different from the old network, and still you want a functional output that is as close as possible to the functional output that you've lost. So that needs to be reestablished by repairing functional connections in the network. Now, a very simple system in which you can look at that is the optic system. If you look at if you cut an optic nerve in frogs and salamanders or fish, you get regeneration of 100% of the axons. I think actually in frogs, some of the retinal ganglion cells die and they make connections back to the tectum and function returns and everything returns with the same precision that was there. And it looks almost like you get upregulation of cell adhesion molecules and the same sort of cues seem to be followed. But we wanted to know whether that's more or less a passive growth or something that is fundamentally different from development. And we used a few years ago, we used the Estrée mutant, or roundabout 2 mutant, so cell surface receptor that responds to inhibitory cues in the midline. And what you see here is basically the top view of a fish, a larval fish. It's got an eye here, it's got an eye there, and what you see are optic axons, and the optic axons are, like in the control, supposed to just go to the tectum. But instead, in the mutant, and also when we acutely disrupt the function of the gene, they grow into the telencephalon, with sometimes very, very strong projections. So what we did was, we looked at those fish, we picked the ones with the strongest projection to the forebrain, and we raised them. And it turned out that those projections, those inappropriate projections to the telencephalon, were maintained into the adult. So this is a wild-type telencephalon. Naturally, it will not have optic axons because they all course to pretectum and tectum. But in the Estrée mutant, you get very strong projections into the forebrain, and in the morphant as well, you get them. So now you have an aberrant projection, and you can lesion the optic nerve, and you can find out, are the axons just following old cues, or are they actively navigating a territory? And in this rather complicated slide, what we did is we just raised those astray fish to adulthood, and then we cut the optic nerve, let the optic fibers regenerate, and then we traced the optic fibers and looked where they grew. And so this is a wild type and how it regenerates, or how regenerated axons project to the tectum. And here's an astray, and you can see, for example, the projection is quite diffuse. But if you look at the number of errors that you can find, if you look at optic axons in the telencephalon, a lot of animals, astray animals, have them established during development, but in regeneration, they're almost gone. Fibers in the tegmentum, about 1 in 4 animals have them during set in development, but then the number of animals in which you find them after regeneration is significantly reduced. Same for aberrant midline crossing, that is also reduced after injury. So a molecule that is thought indispensable for developmental axonal outgrowth sets up a wrong optic projection, very strong inappropriate projection to the telencephalon. You wait 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, you lesion the optic projection, and the axons now actively pathfind, and they find their targets better than during development. And what does that show? That shows that likely other cellulitis molecules are used, other guidance molecules are used, because now the axons pathfind appropriately. So just to point that out, that axons might reuse some growth-associated molecules, but not all of them. The main work of our lab has been spinal cord regeneration, though. And the reason we do spinal cord regeneration is because fish do it particularly well. And with apologies to the people who've seen these movies like about 15,000 times since 2004, this is an adult fish, an adult zebrafish. It's about 2.5 centimeters from tip of the nose to base of the tail. It's quite nervous. It swims about 12 meters in 5 minutes. And we can watch it with a simple open field setup that you would also use for mice. And this is the same fish that you see here 1 week after a spinal cord injury. I can see the gills moving. You probably can't, but you'll see how the fish tries to move here. And it has the same problem that you or I would have after a spinal cord injury. It can't move the distal part of the body. It's paralyzed. So we keep the very same fish another 5 weeks. We treat it very well. We feed it off a pipette. And then this is how it swims. So this is what I mean by rewiring and getting functional output that is as good as before. This is what happens. So a lot of debate has been made between regeneration and repair, where regeneration really means a recreation of what was there, a faithful reestablishment of what was lost. And that's actually not what's happening in the fish, because if you look at what's happening in the fish, what is regenerated looks very different from what was there before. So this is a cross-section through the spinal cord of an unlesioned zebrafish. It has myelinated tracts on the outside, and then gray matter here and here has the very large mouth nerve axons that are important for the escape reaction. This here is a section through the spinal cord 6 weeks after the lesion, through the lesion site. And what you can see is there's a little bit of an outside and an inside, and the outside are axons, very large axons, myelinated by Schwann cells, not by oligodendrocytes, and then lots of unmyelinated axons on the inside. But there's not really a central canal, there's no real dorsal or ventral or structure to it. Yet the fish swim like I've just showed you they swim as if nothing had happened. So we know that axonal regrowth is really, really important for that. As soon as we get 3 neurons to extend an axon over the injury site, you get some recovery. So we had a PhD student in the lab, Bettina Lieberoth, who did lots and lots of fish and found that out. What she also did is she did spinal cord injuries, and she stuck a piece of Teflon tape into the injury site at the time of the injury, physically barring the axons from regrowing. And when you do that, they don't recover. They basically swim after 6 weeks, like after 1 week after injury. So the growth of the axons across the injury site is really, really important. If you don't get that, you don't get functional recovery. But the anatomical recovery that you get is still crap. It's not very good. And then furthermore, the axons don't grow where they originally came from. So we had a look at where the axons come from, and they come from the peripheral white matter. So this here is a cross-section from proximal to the injury site, but then they course into the distal gray matter. So I don't know who of you is versed in spinal cord injury, but in, I think, 1999, there was a science paper by Chang and Olsen. And what they did is they took some peripheral nerve and put it into a spinal cord injury and surgically connected the proximal white matter to the distal gray matter in rats, and then some axons could regenerate. And it seems that the fish is doing that naturally. So there's even more difference between the regenerated structure to the originally generated structure, and yet the fish swims very well. And just to show you how huge that is, so this is the descending projection before injury. All the axons come from the white matter tracts, and this is the regenerated projection distal to the injury, where up to 90% of the axons are in the gray matter. And you can also see that some fish have very few axons. So these are only about 35 that grow in this fish. Yet they swim very well. So we argued there must be something in terms of plasticity that's going on. So what we looked at is we looked at proliferation in the spinal cord. So for all intents and purposes, the adult spinal cord, or the spinal cord of the adult zebrafish, is quiescent. You can repeatedly inject them with BRDU, and there is no growth. That's different to the retina and to the tectum, which are continuously growing throughout life, also in the zebrafish. But the spinal cord, most neurons are born after 3 days, and there's not much going on after that. But if you, and this is a PCNA cross-section, and then this is a lesion spinal cord, and you can see that suddenly there's a huge number of profiles. Within 3 days after injury, you have about 30 profiles per 50-micron section around the central canal, and that increases up to 14 days and then tapers off to 6 weeks. And that's about when regeneration plateaus and recovery doesn't get better. So huge amount of proliferation. So where does this come from? What proliferates? If you look into the spinal cord, what you have is around the central canal, you have cells with a cell body lining the vitricular surface, and Anders knows them very well because they exist in the salamander as well. They have a long radial process and an end at the pia. We call them ependymal radial glial cells, a bit of a mouthful, and some people have used the term. It's maybe a bit too long to be catching on. In any case, here we have them, and those are the cell whose cell bodies proliferate. And if you look what happens, these are just the sonic hedgehog GFP-expressing cells that sit just at the ventral edge of the central canal, and you can see their long processes, and after injury, these get a lot more. So they make more of themselves. The central canal gets wider. That's something that happens in any species. So these cells proliferate and make more of themselves. Sonic hedgehog gets upregulated, and then patched gets upregulated just dorsolateral of that, and overlaps with expression of OLIC2. Now, anyone who works in neural development or has learned neural development goes, well, this reminds me of something. Domains that express OLIC2 and patched in development in the ventrolateral area of the neural tube make motor neurons. And indeed, so do ours. So this is a cross-section through an unlesioned fish. You see OLIC2 GFP-expressing cells, and they don't double label with HB9, a motor neuron marker. You can see some large motor neurons here, older motor neurons. Then you lesion, and your OLIC2 cells get more, and most of them suddenly express the HB9 nuclear antigen. So you basically convert a cell that during development made motor neurons back to its, you're reminded of its original fate, and it switches back from occasionally spitting out the odd oligodendrocyte to now making masses of motor neurons. And literally masses, we get 1,200 in a 1.5 millimeter stretch across the lesion site. So quite a few. And then this is the HB9 you just saw. This is the central canal, and the motor neurons are being born sort of lateral ventral to that, and just dorsal to that, you get loads of new VSX1 interneurons, so V2 interneurons, and they arise from a domain that is OLIC2 negative, but it's PAX6 positive and NKX6.1 positive, and they are newborn after the injury. So what we found out over a series of papers was that basically what happens after injury is that sonic hedgehog gets upregulated. It's always there. There's always a little blip at the ventral edge of the central canal. And then all the developmental transcription factors that are expressed in the ventral neural tube are upregulated, and you get neurogenesis from these spinal progenitor cells that give you motor neurons, V2 interneurons, serotonergic interneurons from the developmentally appropriate positions. But again, this is not like during development where you have to pattern the spinal cord and you don't have any surrounding tissue going on, but it's integration of new neurons. It's not recapitulation of the entire structure. It's just the ventral aspect that gets replaced or reactivated. So we're saying these ependymal radial glial cells have their soma at the ventricular surface, long process, and then an enfort at the pia. You find them in the telencephalon as well, in the salamander midbrain, in the fish spinal cord. You also have very similar cells in the mammalian spinal cord. It's just that their processes are not quite as long, and many of them end at subpial blood vessels. And they are proper progenitor cells for adult CNS repair. Now, in the series of papers that I had quoted in the slide before, we had looked at various developmental factors, and we found that sonic hedgehog was important for neurogenesis, and we found that Notch was important for neurogenesis, and a colleague found that FGF was important for neurogenesis, and editors were going a bit, where's the novelty? You know, how can you use this for discovery, and what else is specific about this regenerative neurogenesis? Because we know that sonic hedgehog and Notch and FGF are important for neurogenesis. And it's very difficult in an adult fish to be able to do discovery. So what we did a few years ago is to develop a spinal cord injury paradigm in larval zebrafish. And that is because they're small and they're translucent and you have many of them. A fish couple can lay about 200 eggs in a morning. So you get a fair number of N. You have easy, very, very easy genetics compared to the salamander. And also the spinal circuitry is established really, really early. So the fish develop into something with a beating heart, a peripheral nervous system, a central nervous system, a brain within 24 hours. And after 3 days, they hatch. And then when they hatch, they're liable to predation. Anyone who's seen Finding Nemo knows that bigger fish eat smaller fish. So I'm just going to show you a bit of a nightmare scenario to convince you that a zebrafish does have a functioning locomotor system. So this particular fish is 4 days old, and it escapes this dragonfly larva. Dave McLean, who made this movie in Joe Fetcher's lab, assures me it's the only fish that escaped this dragonfly larva because they're really very hungry. So you have a small vertebrate that is translucent. You can stick under a microscope in its entirety, and it has a functional locomotor system that responds to touch and allows an escape reaction. So we take that, and we give it a spinal cord injury here in the dorsal part of the fish. You can see that about the dorsal 40% are cut, and we go just to the notochord. And then within 48 hours, this heals over nicely. And I have this asterisk here to say, under European legislation, the fish becomes an animal here. So you can look at the entire regeneration while this is not considered an animal experiment. And that might seem sort of unintellectual, but of course, it's often an important consideration. Within 48 hours post-injury, you get a very nice axonal bridge formation. So this is a side view of the spinal cord in a tubulin stain. We cut here, so this is freshly lesioned. You can see a clear gap. You know that you have transected all axons. And then within 24 hours post-injury, you get 40% of fish with an axonal bridge, and you get 80% after 2 days. You don't get more than that at plateaus, and we don't know what happens to the 20%, but they don't regenerate very well. Along with the axonal regeneration, you get functional recovery, so directly after injury, 24 hours later, 48 hours later, they catch up with their unlesioned peers, and that recovery drops to zero if you re-injure them. And also, if you look at fish with a bridge and without an axonal bridge, the ones with a bridge are no longer different from their unlesioned peers, whereas the ones without a bridge don't swim. So it's exactly like in the adult, in the sense that axons are important for functional recovery. So we have a fast robust anatomical and functional readout for repair. So then we can use that to analyze what's happening in the injury site. So one of the things I talked about in the adult fish was neurogenesis, and one of the things we managed to discover in the young fish, which may have escaped us maybe in the old one, is that the progenitor cells that I introduced, the ERG cells here sitting at the central canal and having their long process, after injury, generate new motor neurons, and they do that. These are the new motor neurons that they generated, but they also generate this cell type here. So all of these cells are new. They sit just proximal and just distal to the injury site, and their axon just grows across the injury site. It's like a relay station. It just hops over the injury site. And these are, they think they're motor neurons. They're labeled by HP9-GFP. And they probably do what motor neurons do. They sit with their cell body in the CNS, and they grow their axon into a non-CNS environment, and then they find the other side. What that means is that ultimately the regenerated projection is a network that's built with new building blocks that is no longer just built by the neurons and axons that were originally there and are repaired, but a new Lego block has been thrown into the mix. We can look at all contributions or contributions of any cell that we desire. So this is again just staining tubulin, this time transgenically. So you can see how the axonal bridge forms, and you can follow that. And then you can cross these fish into any reporter fish that you'd like to see whether they might be important for repair. So this here is one that shows all myelinating cells in green, and you can see one day after injury, very few in the injury site, some more after 2 days, and then after 3 days, really what happens is those new axons are being remyelinated. Here you have blood vessels, and you can see that after injury, basically there's a gap, there are no blood vessels in the injury site, the axonal bridges happen, and then after 4 days after injury, you get re-establishment of the nice blood vessels. Again, the blood vessels come a bit late to be a substrate for axons. This here was interesting. So this is a PDGF receptor beta GFP fish, and Anders had mentioned the pericytes. So this labels perivascular pericytes. So we do our injury, and before the injury, they all sat around the blood vessels, and after injury, they are massively within the injury site. So this is 1 day post-injury, very nicely coinciding with all the neuronal elements in the injury site. And then 2 days after injury, 67% of the injury site are covered with these pericytes. And then they sort of withdraw again, and 4 days post-injury, you see them around the blood vessels again. So what are those pericytes doing in the injury site? Well, what we know they do is they deposit lots of extracellular matrix. So here's, again, tubulin stain, showing the axons that grow across the injury site. Here's fibronectin and collagen 1, and you can see that they basically make these fibrils that extend across the injury site, fill the injury site, collagen 1 much more organized than the fibronectin. And then in a study that we published a couple of years ago, we looked at collagen 12. So these are the axons here, and then this is collagen 12, which is also nicely aligned between the two stumps and aligns with the axons very nicely. I'm going to stop here before anyone gets ill. And we basically found out in a series of experiments that after injury, fibroblasts, and some of which are pericyte-derived, migrate into the injury site and secrete collagen 12 into the injury site. And that is essential and sufficient for axonal regeneration. So if you take it away, axons do not regenerate as well. And if you add some, if you overexpress collagen 12, axons grow better. Now, to remind you that this very complex injury site that you just saw was in a 3 millimeter long fish. So you have a very complex environment through which these axons navigate. And this is very, very different from anything that you get during development. And I was just going to say that the same thing seems to happen in adult fish. So this is tubulin, and the red ones here are fibrils of collagen 12. So you get collagen 12 deposition also in adult fish. So one of the things that happens after injury already in 3-day-old fish that have a full complement of the innate immune system is an immune system reaction. We heard from Sophie Friis about H2O2. So what happens when you lesion the fish? This one here is labeled with a calcium indicator. You can see the calcium wave beautifully extending from the injury site. The calcium wave leads to release of H2O2. And what does H2O2 do? It attracts neutrophils. So here we have neutrophils just at the injury site. If you inhibit the release of H2O2, no neutrophils come to the injury site. So calcium, H2O2, and then neutrophils arrive. Neutrophils attract macrophages. So here we have the red neurons. You see the gap where we did the injury, and we have cyan labeled macrophages, and they come and they migrate in. They remove some, they remove some neuronal debris, but they also often just linger. They almost look like, you know, I think of Kobe beef. They come and they sort of massage the injury site. Not all of them are eating, not all of them are eating neuronal elements. We can watch all of that in exquisite detail. Are they really relevant? We can stick the entire larva into dexamethasone, suppress the immune system, and see what that does to axonal regeneration. And if we do that, then 48 hours after injury, when our control fish, 80% have an axonal bridge, and our dexamethasone immunosuppressed animals, only about 30% have an axonal bridge. So yes, inflammation seems to be doing something important. Can we make regeneration better? Yes, we can. If we treat the fish with lipopolysaccharides, basically mimicking a sterile infection or giving them a sterile infection, and we come and look after one day where only 40% of our fish in the control group have an axonal bridge, we can get them up to 60 by stimulating an infection. So apparently, or stimulating the immune system. So apparently, the immune system is good for axonal repair, which is a bit weird because in mammals, we know that if the immune system stays excited, then regeneration is definitely impaired. We were very lucky when we started looking at the immune system. Will Talbot in Stanford had made a fish that is mutated in a transcription factor, IRF8, and these fish do not have macrophages and they don't have microglia. So we could look at regeneration in a fish that neither has microglia here, these red cells here, or macrophages, the purple cells in the wild type here, not there in the mutant. And if we look at how axonal regeneration proceeds in them, we find that there is a long-term impairment in axonal regeneration IRF8 mutants. So the IRF8 mutants are here in blue. At one day post-injury, they still regenerate, about 40% have an axonal bridge, but then they linger at that 40% and they don't get much better. And there is a long-term functional impairment as well that goes along with this. So again, we're taking away microglia, we're taking away macrophages, two of those innate immune system cells, and regeneration gets worse. So we were wondering what could do that, and what could be the difference the deciding difference between the IRF8 and our wild types. And one of the things that they do have more of is not neutrophils. So they don't have macrophages, don't have microglia, because you play with the myeloid lineage, you get more neutrophils. And it doesn't look like much. They have about 10 more neutrophils per injury site about 2 hours after injury. But then if you look at 24 hours and at 48 hours, there are a lot more neutrophils hanging around. Fish being fish, you can take away their neutrophils as well. So we took IRF8 mutants, and we injected them with a combination of PU1 and GCSF morpholino, and that reduces the number of neutrophils that are being born in those fish, not to zero, but reduces them significantly. And when we then look at axonal repair in this fish that doesn't have macrophages, doesn't have microglia, and doesn't have neutrophils, then there is some rescue. So you go from 40% of fish with axonal bridge to 60%. So there's something in the neutrophils that seems to impair axonal growth from day two. What could that be? We talked at lunch about what the immune system does. And what it does is release cytokines. And these cytokines do not only act on our particular tissue type of interest, in this case axons, but they also act on each other. So neutrophils are there. They release cytokines that attract macrophages. The macrophages interact with the microglia. So it becomes, if you look at it in conjunction with axons, it becomes like a four-body problem, very difficult to predict. So we did a quick candidate screen, so to speak, and just picked two pro-inflammatory cytokines and two anti-inflammatory cytokines. And we see there's if you just concentrate on the black, which is the wild-type curve, there's an early peak of pro-inflammatory IL-1-beta and pro-inflammatory TNF-alpha, and then that sort of tapers off in the subsequent hours. Whereas if you look at the anti-inflammatory cytokines, TGF-beta-1, TGF-beta-3, you see that they're relatively low early and then they increase. So far, so good. What happens in the IRF8? They still have the early peak in IL-1, but then the IL-1 stays high in the mutant, the IL-1 beta stays high in the IRF8 mutant, and the TNF-alpha goes even higher and is even higher. So maybe there's an excess of pro-inflammatory cytokines that mediate the failure of axonal regeneration. And we can watch that as it happens in the fish. So this is an IL-1 beta GFP indicator fish. And this movie starts 30 minutes after injury, and you can see how neutrophils arrive, and they are already positive for IL-1 beta, and then basically the entire surrounding tissue gets pulled in and is generating lots of IL-1 beta. So the entire injury site is full of IL-1 beta. So what if we get rid of the IL-1 beta? We did that in three different ways. We used a pharmacological approach. EVAT is a short peptide, and it inhibits caspase 1, and caspase 1, or the main function of caspase 1, is to cleave IL-1 beta into its active form. If we inhibit caspase 1, then we can rescue axonal regeneration in the IRF8 mutant. Then we used morpholinos, and if we use morpholinos to inhibit the generation of IL-1 beta, we can rescue a little bit the IRF8 mutant or axonal regeneration in IRF8 mutant. If we use CRISPRs and mutate the IL-1 beta in the IRF8 mutant, then we can almost fully rescue the axonal growth. So by taking out one cytokine out of this mutant that doesn't have macrophages, doesn't have microglia, we can rescue axonal growth, this axonal growth deficit. And this goes along with rescue of swimming behavior. So that was great. We thought, well, that's wonderful. That's our first cytokine, and now we're going to take the TNF-alpha and we're going to make the fish even better. And we did that first by pomalidomide, which is a thalidomide relative that inhibits the release of TNF-alpha. And when we look in the IRF8, after 2 days, there is no rescue. So that was surprising. And what was even more surprising was that suddenly our wild-type axons didn't regenerate quite as well. So if we treated wild-type with TNF-alpha, they also were impaired. So we thought we'd do that in a genetic fashion. So we injected guide RNA and Cas9 mRNA into IRF8 fish, and then after 72 hours injured them, and then came back after 2 days and looked how well regeneration happened. And indeed, regeneration was significantly impaired if you mutate TNF-alpha. How could that happen? Well, we know that neutrophils are bad and IL-1 beta are bad. So we looked for neutrophils numbers and IL-1 beta amount in the injury site. And when we mutate TNF-alpha, we have the same number of macrophages at the injury site, but we have significantly more neutrophils. And we also have a significantly increased amount of IL-1 beta. And just this slide is just for Simone, because he keeps asking. IL-1 beta has a bit of a complicated receptor system where you have two different receptor subunits, and then you have an additional IL-1 beta RN element that can inhibit the receptor binding. So basically, when IL-1 receptor 1 and IL-1 RAP are there, then IL-1 signaling can happen, and the more of IL-1 RN you have, the more the signaling is reduced. So we fax-sorted neurons from fish after injury and did qRT-PCR for the different receptor components, and we saw that the R1 is significantly upregulated. The RAP is there, but not upregulated, and the RN is significantly downregulated, so neuronal sensitivity to IL-1 beta signaling is likely increased in neurons after injury, so they can receive the signal as well. So the picture that we have is after injury, you have a cascade of calcium, of H2O2 that attracts neutrophils to the injury. The neutrophils release cytokines, amongst them IL-1 beta. They attract macrophages, and the macrophages come and they inhibit, they basically act as anti-inflammatory agents. They dampen the expression of IL-1 beta in neutrophils, they reduce the number of neutrophils, and thereby allow axonal regeneration. So we can see that CNS regeneration is a very complex process, and it's very distinct from development, because you have a much different environment through which axons have to regenerate than during the environment that they had to originally grow, which includes a lot of new components, for example, cells of the innate immune system and completely different extracellular matrix. We know that regeneration involves axonal regrowth, but also also regenerative neurogenesis, and that's under the influence of the immune system. And we can track that very nicely visually and also genetically in our optically and genetically and pharmacologically accessible system. And we found that IL-1 beta is detrimental to axonal regeneration, and macrophage-derived TNF-alpha is necessary for axonal regeneration by keeping neutrophil numbers and IL-1 beta in check. So just to thank the people who were involved, most importantly, Themis. This was our last half year. We had 4 PhD students finish. Themis is the person who did the IL-1 beta story. The Becker group is myself and Thomas, who's in the audience as well, and our postdocs. Marcus is our CRISPR jockey, Jason, our imaging facility manager. We have a number of master students who each get a gene to CRISPR and then find out fantastic things. And we are funded by a lot of people for whom we are really thankful, including an ERA Net Neuron, to come back to the European idea, an ERA Net Neuron co-fund grant that was funded on the British side by Medical Research Council, Spinal Research and Wings for Life. And I'm just going to leave that up as the last slide.